Accession number 29566, Reel 3.
And Spicer, Reel 3. So what happened next? You were all standing outside the guard room.
Right, we were all standing outside the guard room, and then we were split into groups, and I guess there must have been 24 in each group. Yeah, about 24 in each group. We were marched along to a barrack room, which was, on entering, was quite a shock, really. It was quite dirty, and in the corner there was an old, one of these old black stoves with a pipe that went up into the roof and disappeared. And this thing was not lit, and remember, we're in January, February-ish, freezing cold, because winters then seem to be much worse than they are now. There was very, very heavy frost, but it was bitterly cold. And this place was just like an ice box. And we were told to pick a bed space. There were beds, I think about 12 each side, so that would take care of the 24. And these beds were the fold-up type. They had these fold-up legs, so they were very rickety. So you had to pull the legs out and snap them into place. And they had rusty old springs on the metal framework. We were told to dump our small suitcase and any other personal belongings on them, and then outside again, and we were taken along to the stores to collect a mattress, a pillow, two pillows, and pillowcases and sheets. And then we were taken back to the barrack room, and this is all at the double. And for those who don't know what that means, is you don't walk, you run, with suitable encouragement from the NCO in charge, like, get a bloody move on. So we got back to the barrack room, and we dumped this mattress on this bed, and we were then shown how to make the bed up, rather like a nurse would be shown in their training today. All the corners tucked in, and the sheet laid over the top of the blanket and everything like that, so it looked very neat and tidy. Then we were allocated a metal locker, which was rather like one of these brown office things. Some of them had locks on, some of them didn't. They were broken, they were in a hell of a state. Then we were told outside again to the stores to collect your kit. Now this was something to behold, because just one other thing I've just remembered. When we first arrived at the barrack room, we noticed that one bed space actually was already occupied. It had its bed made up, but there was nobody there. Anyway, when we got, we went off to the stores, and we were given a wonderful selection of ill-fitting clothes, such as pants, which were known as drawers cellular. We had socks, vests, shirts, which were like sandpaper to wear. They were very, very rough, awful things. Ties, denims, which are a type of khaki overall, and you wear these when you're not wearing your battle dress, and they're for just general use. You use those most of the time that you're in. We got two battle dress uniforms. One was supposed to be best BD, and the other one was second best BD. We had a housewife, which was a sewing kit, which contained needles, cotton, spare buttons, hooks and all that sort of thing. We got a mug, plate, knife, fork, greatcoat, boot, two pairs of boots, one pair of best boots, one pair of not so best boots. The best boots were supposed to be balled up so that you could shave in them, but I'll come back to that a little later on. We got a large pack, we got a small pack, we got two pouches, we got a belt, we got cross straps, we got gaiters. And all this stuff was just piled on top of you. And you were told to take this lot back to the barrack room. And woe betide anybody that dropped anything on their way from the stores to the barrack room. So you can imagine 24 blokes coming out the stores, couldn't see where they were going with this stuff piled high in the air, trying to find your way back to a barrack room that you'd only visited twice. And it was absolute bedlam. I've never seen anything so funny in all my life.
When you got back to the barrack room, you said that there had been a bed that was unoccupied when you were there, but made up.
Yeah. Yeah. When we got back to the barrack room, we found out that the bed that had been made up had, in fact, belonged to a chap about 30 to 35, who to us seemed really ancient. But he introduced himself as Charlie. Apparently he was an old soldier that had done, I don't know, 15 years service or so. But he'd come out and he'd re-enlisted. So in the weeks, days and weeks to come, Charlie was an absolute godsend to us because he knew every wrinkle in the book. And we were very, very fortunate in having him in our hut because he taught us things that it had taken him years to learn. And he gave us every little wrinkle that you could think on how to clean your kit out, what to do, what not to do. But he was very, very useful. Anyway, the next thing we were told to do was put all this kit in your locker and fall in outside because you were going to be taken to the naffy. So we thought, oh, good, a cup of tea or something. But that was not the purpose. You all marched along to the naffy, where out of your own pocket, I might add, at this stage, you were all ordered to buy a block of Blanco and a tin of Brasso. The Blanco was for colouring your webbing equipment. It was a water-based material in a block form. You had a brush with it and you used to mix water with it and get it into a sort of a paste and then brush it all over your webbing. And the Brasso was for the brassy bits. But the thing was, all the webbing they gave you, and it happened to every intake that I can ever remember, all the webbing to start off with was filthy dirty. It was stained, there were oil marks on it. You really had to clean this stuff up first before you put the Blanco on. Anyway, we spent an hour or so trying to clean this stuff up best way we could, and then we were taken along to what then these training establishments, they had special, what they called Blanco sheds, put aside. All they were a long hut with long tables where you put your webbing equipment, and they had taps on the end. You used to get some water and mix your Blanco up and then cover all your equipment with this Blanco. And this was an ongoing process. This just wasn't just a one-off. All your webbing equipment was usually Blancoed every day after that. and then that was left to dry. And while that was left to dry, we were taken, we were marched to the cookhouse for our first meal.
What was the cookhouse like?
The cookhouse, now that was something else. On entering the cookhouse, we were greeted with a loud cheer and banging of tables and mugs being rattled. And this, we found out, was the welcome that every new entry got when they arrived in the cookhouse. No matter where you went over the UK, apparently this is well known. Every intake is greeted by the same procedure. Anyway, the food, to say the least, was quite unappetizing. All the food seemed to be cold, and it was sort of flopped onto your plate. The only thing that was hot was the tea. But the tea had a most peculiar taste. And we were told later that the tea contained a chemical called bromide. Now, why would they want to put bromide in the tea, we thought. So we inquired about this. And the corporal said, well, you lads have got a job to do, he said. We don't want you thinking about other things. So we said, well, what are you talking about? You know, so he said, well, you know about bloody women and girlfriends, for Christ's sake, he said. We don't want you to have any carnal thoughts. We want you to concentrate your mind on becoming soldiers. So he said, and bromide is put into your tea to dampen down your ardour. So we said, oh, all right. So anyway, this went over our heads because we didn't really take any notice of this. Anyway, this went on. All this rushing around went on until quite late on in the evening, and by the time we got to bed, we were absolutely bloody knackered, you know. We were flopped, and that was it.
Could I ask about the type of food they were serving? You said it was cold, but what type?
Yeah, it was sort of cold eggs, and the toast was stale. I mean, the food was just disgusting. I mean. In the following morning, which I'll come to in a moment, I can perhaps explain that a little bit better. But anyway, eventually we must have dropped off to sleep, only to be woken at about, I think it was about 5:45 in the morning by some very nice gentleman blowing a bugle, which seemed right outside the barrack room window. And then there were two or three corporals that sort of seemed to burst into the barrack room. And in very impolite language, telling us or encouraging us to get out of bed. Go and have a wash and a shave and be outside in 20 minutes where you'll be marched out to the cookhouse for breakfast. And I remember the platoon outside then, when the barrack rooms had emptied, we were all standing there in these denim uniforms, which was like the khaki overalls, ill-fitting boots, a berry, which didn't fit, clutching knife, fork, spoon, plates and a mug. And there were 39 of us in our platoon. And then we marched along to the cookhouse. Once again, we were greeted with a loud cheer. Breakfast consisted of what looked like, well, it was porridge, but it looked like wallpaper paste. And I've never tasted wallpaper paste, but I should imagine it tasted like wallpaper paste. There were bacon and eggs, which the eggs were cold and slimy, but everything was swimming in fat. And the people that were dishing it up were completely expressionless, and all this stuff was dished out from either large billy cans or big flat trays. And they each had a big spoon, and they used to scoop up a big spoonful of whatever you wanted, and it was whack onto the side of the billy can, and it flopped from the spoon to your plate, and it was just unbelievable. And you know, but I mean, you were so hungry, you just ate it. There was no flavour or taste. It was just bulk, basically. You just ate this stuff for the sake of filling up a hole. Again, the only thing that was warm was the tea. Now, outside the cookhouse, there were supposed to be washing facilities for washing your utensils. Now, this consisted of 3 45-gallon drums that had been sawn in half. So you can imagine a half of a 45-gallon drum. And they were on a wooden cradle. Underneath the wooden cradle was supposed to be a fire. But either the fires hadn't been lit, or they put stuff on that wasn't very efficient in burning. So the water at best was tepid. And it had a wonderful layer of grease all over the top. And you very gingerly dipped your plates into this thing, and some of the blokes even fetched toilet roll with them, and they just wiped it off. You know, there was no hot running water in the wash houses, and you had to sort of clean it up best way you could. You know, it was awful. You know, you were clutching these things that were half clean and half with egg on, and it was all greasy, and it was just a nightmare. I just, you know, just couldn't understand it at all.
What did they do after you'd been to have breakfast? Did you have to go and report somewhere else?
Yeah. The next thing we were introduced to when we got back, and we put all our... We went along to the wash basins and we cleaned off in cold water the best way we could the rest of this muck on our plates. Went back to the bath room, and then we were told to parade outside again. And then we went back into the barrack room, and we were introduced to the washrooms and urinals, which the corporals told us, again, like the barrack room, it was our responsibility. We had to keep everything clean. The urinals were not state of the art. They were clean, but in inverted commas clean. And the sit-down toilets, a lot of the seats were broken, stained pans. And they were in a pretty sorry state, but we were told we would have to clean them up best way we could. And even the little metal bits where the water flushes out at the top of the toilets, a lot of those were all sort of green mildew, but we were told they've got to be cleaned as well. They've got to be cleaned with Brasso. All your cleaning materials inside the barrack room, such as your brooms and a thing called a bumper, which was a mop, really, that you used to put all polish on, because all the floors in the barrack room were wood, and they had to be bumped, what was known as bumped. It's just a technical name for being highly polished. And these, it was, in the end, by the time you'd finished, they were like, it was like a skating rink. You had to clean windows. You had to dust everywhere, top of your locker, all the bed spaces, all the rungs of the bed. And it is amazing, and any serving soldier, even now probably, on a training establishment will tell you the same thing. It is amazing how the NCOs know where to look for dust. And I'll bet you any money you like, they will find dust. Don't matter how many times you go through a barrack room, they will find dust somewhere. And if they find dust, you are in dead trouble.
Where would be the places that they would look that you might not think about initially?
Well, it's not so much a question of where you wouldn't look. It's where you probably forget. You'd think, you know, you can do it in your own home, really. You can go through your own home with a duster and you think you've done a wonderful job. But somewhere, I mean, even in this lounge of mine, I can go over to a place and I can go like that with my finger and I'll find dust somewhere. But they know where to look. It's years and years of experience. They will find dust anywhere. Doesn't matter where it is, they'll find it. They'll even open the inside of your locker and they'll run their finger underneath the lip of the locker and they'll find dust.
How did it work? Obviously, you were responsible within the barrack room to look after the barrack room. And I take it that you were responsible for your own kit.
Oh, yes.
How did you divide up who cleaned the floor, who cleaned the washroom?
Usually, we split it down the middle. We'd do week a week about. So one half of the barrack room would do the barrack room. The other half would do the wash house and urinals, and then the second week we'd swap. We'd do urinals and wash house, they would do barrack room. But all the time you are aware that you've got to keep everything spotless, so consequently if a bloke comes running into the barrack room, and don't forget in those days all the boots were heavily blaked, they were a mass of blakies, and you would perhaps scratch, and it would be nothing to see a bloke walk across the floor and a scratch mark would appear and another bloke would come out with the bumper and bump it up as soon as he'd done it, because you know, you dare not leave anything to chance, because you could have an NCO come into the room and spot that straight away and you were in dead trouble. And it didn't only just affect the one person, the whole block were in trouble. It wasn't a case of one person took the blame, you were all to blame.
What about personal kit? How did you have to lay that out, and was that the same thing as with the room, that you were responsible for it and it had to be in a certain style?
The day, I think it was the day after we arrived, we were told to do our own kit up, like the civvies and that, in a brown paper bag, including the suitcase, put brown paper wrap around it, address it, and that was sent back to your home address. Your personal kit was laid out every day on the bed, and it was laid out in such a manner. You had your blankets were rolled up and rolled round your pillow. You had your pack with the pouches on top of your locker, but all the rest of your kit was laid out on the bed in a very uniform fashion. Boots were turned uppermost so that they could see the soles, because in some establishments, I don't think it affected Colchester, but if you went to, say, somewhere like Catterick or one of the main guards depots, the blokes even had to polish the blakies. I mean, I've known blokes that have taken the paint off of the eyelets of their boots and polished the eyelets of the boots so it appears that they're brass. But everything was laid out in a uniform fashion. All the utensils that you used, the broom, the bumper, all the handles had to be scraped with a razor blade until they were almost white. Each room had a bucket. That bucket, a metal, ordinary metal bucket, had to be polished, and I've seen them like this, believe you me. They are polished so highly you could shave in them. Absolutely magnificent, but completely unnecessary.
How do you get to that stage of polishing something?
It's just hard graft, plenty of elbow grease, unlike your boots. Now, coming back to Charlie, the old sweat, we were told that we'd got to, on one pair of boots, the best pair of boots, we had to ball the toes and the backs. Now, the term ball is short for bullshit, which is highly polished and means absolutely bugger all. You know, it completely unnecessary. I mean, I think they still do it today, but not to the same extent that we did it. Now, when you get a pair of boots, army boots, not like the ones they have now. I think all army boots now are rubber-soled, so they don't make a noise. Then they were all Blakeys and big irons on the heels. But when you get a pair of boots, they're all pimples all over them, little pimples, black pimples. Now, you cannot bull up boots in that condition. So what you do is, as Charlie told us, you get a fork, and you either, by that time, by the way, we'd lit the fire. So we had a ready source of heat. But you used to take the top off of the burner and lay your fork on this thing until it was fairly hot or even red hot. And then you would take your fork and you'd run over the toe of the boot, and you'd literally burn off the top layer of pimples. And you did the same at the back as well, only on that side and that side. Not all the way round, but just the two back bits. And then once you've got all the pimples off, you have to start bulling. Now, bulling is, again, just a matter of hard work, loads of elbow grease, and it's time. You can't bull up a pair of boots in 24 hours. It comes by a very gradual process, and all it is you get a cloth, wrap it round your finger, you take a nice helping of black polish, and you rub it well into the surface, and you keep doing that in little round circles. And then you've heard the expression spit and polish. This is where that comes from. You literally spit. You have your lid of your tin, and you spit into that. You have a nice collection of saliva, and you dip your finger in the polish, little circles. You dip your finger in the spit, and little circles. And you just do that monotonously. And you can do this for an hour or so, and then you can get a nice one of these yellow dusters, you know, these yellow dusters that you can buy. We used to have those. And you just literally polish. And you do this from the day that you went in until the day you come out. But by the end of 12 weeks, your boots, the polish gradually builds up. And as the polish builds up, it looks in the end as though they've just been coated with a clear varnish. They're like mirrors. This is why you're given two pairs of boots, because the best pair you use only for parades, or you should only use them for parades and official occasions. The second pair of boots you don't bull up, because you use those for everyday work. So you're crawling about in them, or you were running up walls or whatever. So obviously they scratch like blazes. Now, if you scratch your best boots, you can't get it out. It's, you know, if you do a dig in the toe, it's a hell of a job to get it out. I mean, I have known blokes actually to try putting varnish on their on their boats so that it wouldn't have to do this monotonous pulling. But the trouble with varnish after a while is it cracks, and the NCOs know when you've polished or varnished your boats.